The next case this morning is 5210416, People versus Johnson. Arguing for the state as the appellant is Pat Daly. Arguing for the defendant appellee is Kyle Smith. Each side will have 10 minutes for the argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings.
Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Your
Honor. Mr. Daly, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Daly. I'm here on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. This is an appeal by the state of the dismissal of charges of aggravated battery. The issue before the court was whether the defendant's due process rights were violated. Parties have also discussed whether there was a discovery violation issue here. I think probably best to start with a concessionary note. The Carbondale Police Department in this case dropped the ball, okay? They were told to get a Walmart video that they had observed at the time of the incident, which was a battery in the parking lot of a Walmart in Carbondale. They were directed by the prosecutor to go back to get that video, but by the time, due to miscommunication between the police officers, that they got that video, the video had been purged or written over by Walmart. The court's familiar with the facts of the case, but I'm going to go ahead and just do kind of a quick synopsis, because I think the facts of this case are important to frame the legal issues involved. So the police did observe the video. They did not get a copy of it. It was, however, obviously made known, and well, it was actually included as part of a probable cause statement. The contents of the video and the contents of the probable cause statement are not in the record. The parties do reference it, but there's no discussion of it at the time of the hearing. But the state did disclose in its discovery response that it was aware of the video and that it was going to get it. And then once it got it, it was going to disclose it as part of its duties under the Supreme Court rules. However, as it turned out, that video, by the time the police ever got to it, you know, more than 90 days had elapsed. And so if they had done it properly, they would have gotten it. So thus the police did not do their job. The question is here is whether dismissal of the charges under this factual framework is appropriate. The parties have addressed both the discovery and due process. I'm going to start with the due process argument, the due process issue, mainly because this is the argument that the defendant raised below in their motion to dismiss. They cite due process specifically along with Newberry. The state discusses Newberry in the due process context as well. Counsel for the defendant notes, I think, that the court kind of sort of talked a little bit about both. That's arguably correct, although I do think that the court's ultimate decision was due process premised. Due process law as it relates to dismissal of charges is pretty well established. The kind of the leading case that most other decisions refer back to is Arizona versus Youngblood. And it stands for, I think, really the principal proposition that courts have the power to dismiss charges on the basis of due process, where evidence is destroyed or not properly preserved. But in the instance in which due process is applicable, here has to be a showing of bad faith on the part of the government. In this case, there's no bad faith on the part of the government. The defendant's counsel below conceded that there was no bad faith and acknowledged as much. And I think everyone also acknowledges it's really uncertain about the value of the video itself. The court found in its ruling that there was no showing of bad faith. So that in that context, the due process analysis, I think, is significantly impaired from the defendant's perspective in the absence of bad faith. Now, some years later in Newberry, the Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, kind of took up the Youngblood mantle and said, well, we're going to have a little bit of a different result here because this is a drug case. The evidence of drugs, which is really the central issue of the prosecution, the absence of which the defendant would have no chance of defending the charges without it in terms of independent testing, had been destroyed. So it was going to read into the due process analysis a unique and particularized situation that would apply where that type of character of evidence is at stake. I think the state argued below, and I think the state argued correctly, that that's not the type of evidence that we have in this case. Here there is a video whose, again, we don't know what the contents of it are, is equally likely favorable to the state as to the defendant. But I think moreover, it's not a case whose absence is going to deprive the defendant of the ability to defend against the charges. In fact, the parties below both acknowledged to the court that each side had numerous respective witnesses that was going to present a trial. So while that evidence may be useful or potentially useful to somebody, and we don't know who, could equally be the state as the defendant, it was not of that type of character of evidence that Newberry addressed itself to. Now, I would be remiss as well in discussing Newberry that its premises are debatable, and a number of reviewing courts have gone back to look at Newberry in light of the case of Illinois versus Fisher. Illinois versus Fisher was an appeal actually from an Illinois appellate court decision, which it said, look, that's this Newberry kind of centrality of the evidence importance is not something we ever contemplated or worked into our due process analysis in Youngblood. And we've always maintained that the principal consideration is the lack of or presence of bad faith on the part of the government agent. Now, we all concede, I think, that, or at least I concede, of course, that Newberry is still good law. The Supreme Court had a chance to revisit it in People v. Sutherland, but did not do so, finding that it didn't really need to reach the issue of whether due process requires a showing of bad faith, because it simply found Newberry inapplicable in those circumstances where there was a vehicle that had been lost or given away by the police that was not central to the defense of the case. So what we have here, Your Honors, essentially, is we have a video that was not generated by the police, not ever in the police's possession, not ever in the state's possession. As an issue of preservation, and the court made mention of the fact that, you know, the state was required to preserve this video, I think as a matter of sort of English grammar, it's preservation of something contemplates the possession of something in which you're going to protect against its destruction, but the state here did not actually possess the video. There was no showing of bad faith on the part of the state. In fact, it was conceded explicitly, and the video itself was only potentially useful. So from a due process perspective, I think when we look at the extant case law and we look at the facts of this case, we look at the admissions of the lack of bad faith, that the court's finding of a due process violation, assuming that's what it did find in terms of dismissal of the charges, I think went far beyond that which it should have. And in fact, under these circumstances, I don't think there was a due process violation at all. This doesn't preclude the defendant from challenging the police, we'll call it, I think his defense counsel, I think maybe accurately described as ineptitude in acquiring that evidence. But it doesn't mean that we apply due process wholesale across the board to instances where police agents simply don't do their job properly. Rather, the due process goes strictly to that instance where the state simply, allows the destruction negligently or otherwise, or purposely or in bad faith, evidence that's within its possession. That's even under the Newberry analysis. Now, we're turning here in the last couple of minutes to the discovery issue. Again, discovery is not really ever explicitly stated by any of the parties here. Now, the court did make mention in its order, when you look at it, at least in its verbal order, about the state was put on notice that it had to preserve this particular evidence. I would factually dispute that particular characterization. I think that there was never a request to preserve anything. The state had sort of voluntarily offered up, hey, we're aware of this video, we're going to try to get it, and when we get it to you, we're going to give it to you. So I'm not sure that that's even really true. But I think that really the more germane point of the discovery issue here is when you look at the rule, it requires as part of discovery, and this is an interpretation of the plain language of the Supreme Court rule, that the state is to turn over to the defendant all evidence that it has in its possession and control. This is not evidence that the state ever had in its possession and control. It attempted to get it into its possession and control, but it did not. And so I don't think that by the plain language of the
discovery. But if we stop there, how did it attempt to get it in its control? They viewed it, and then it became in control of Walmart. Is that not correct? And so how did the state, ever try to have it in its control and give that up?
Well, I think that what happened, Your Honor, is that once the state found out that this video existed, the last prosecutor, they tried to go back to Walmart to get a copy of it. And once that copy was made, then that would be obviously a tangible item in the state's control, which it would be required to preserve.
But they didn't do anything.
By the time they got back to go get it, the evidence had already been destroyed.
That's the only time they went back. There's no mid time that they went back.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. Yes. The police did not act promptly when informed to do so by the prosecutor to get that evidence, which is why we're here today, because if they had, they would have gotten it, which wouldn't have been an issue. In the last 15 seconds or so, I do want to say that if the court does find that the court had gone to a proper extent in terms of finding a discovery violation, the sanction of dismissal of charges is a disfavored sanction. It's the most severe sanction. And I think when you look at all the circumstances, particularly as it relates, as I just previously discussed, with the due process violation, that the discovery, that the sanction of complete dismissal was inappropriate, and the court should have considered less drastic and harsh remedies, such as an instruction to the jury that it can presume, evidence that the state had and was not able to present to be favorable to the defendant. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Justice McCaney, Justice Welch, any further questions?
No further questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Daly. You'll have time in rebuttal. Mr. Smith, you are, oh, there you go.
Yep.
Whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Kyle Smith with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I'm representing Mr. Johnson here today. So in order to obtain a reversal and reinstate the charges against Mr. Johnson, the state is required to show that the trial court abused its discretion, that its decision to dismiss the charges was arbitrary, fancy, or...
I have no volume.
All right, you're back on mute. There
Sorry. You Sorry.
You want to restate that, please?
I was just saying that in order to reverse this case, the state's required to show that the trial court abused its discretion. Now, I think both parties can agree that this can be analyzed as either a constitutional due process violation or as a discovery sanction under Rule 415. And the state does concede that this court can affirm on any basis that's supported by the record. I think where we tend to not see eye to eye is that on what the trial court actually ruled on. And I think if you look to the record, the record makes pretty clear that the trial court was treating this as a discovery violation. He said this decision was based on the video not being preserved on request. He found that the defendant had filed a discovery motion, that he had requested the video. He said that there was no bad faith and that the video could potentially support either side. He stated on page 31, clearly there's been a violation. The question is, what is the appropriate sanction? And he went on to note that a dismissal is not required, but it depends on the particular facts. And he also considered the lesser sanctions that were available. This to me reads as a court who is exercising its authority under Rule 415 to choose an appropriate sanction for a violation. This is not how you talk about just due process violation or due process claims. It's true that he did reference briefly Newberry, a case which I might add, it was decided on both due process and discovery grounds. And he also referred to other cases which are involved evidence not being preserved on request. The state has raised some arguments about what counsel argued, but I would say, first of all, the attorney did emphasize that he filed this motion and for discovery and that it had not been preserved. And I would argue that the counsel's arguments are less important because it's the trial court's decision. And I think the trial court got it right here, regardless of what was argued. Now, I think these facts can clearly support a discovery violation. And all that's required is that the defendant filed a motion, that the state responded by disclosing this video and promising to provide a copy, and then it failed to do so. There's no need to show bad faith or any type of that the evidence was favorable or unfavorable. It's really that simple. The state raises this possession argument, claiming it never actually had possession of this video, which I disagree with as a matter of fact or interpretation of the facts, I should say. I would just note that this argument relies on language from 412A, which is about the state's duty to disclose. The state does not mention that Rule 412.4 requires that the state ensures a flow of communication to place within its possession and control any relevant evidence. So that speaks to its ability to, or its obligation rather, to take evidence into its possession. I would also argue this evidence was in the state's possession. on July 7th when there were five officers on the scene watching, and at least one of them was able to watch this video. They had actual physical control and possession over the video. They could have right then and there done something, taken effort to obtain it and to keep it. The fact that they relinquished possession after that and said, okay, I guess we'll just come back later do so, that to me doesn't change the fact that they had possession over the video.
What is the evidence that we're talking about when we're specifically when we're talking about possessing the evidence? Is it the content of the video or is it the video itself? In other words, is it the hard drive it's on? Is it a thumb drive? Is it a CD that was burned or DVD or something like that?
Well, what is speaking to the facts, I don't think the record discloses exactly how it was preserved. I'm assuming it was some sort of digital. I think these are fairly high tech. So I'm assuming it was a computer or something in the
That was my understanding.
I think that that goes to the point, though, that how can you possess a digital file? And I think the state's trying to, you know, mince, change the words and say, well, we didn't actually possess it. But I maintain if you're watching a video, if you're given access by the manager of the Walmart to view a video, they're clearly not saying, you know, that you can't have this. And it's also important to keep in mind, the police work hand in hand with these types of offices all the time. So these requests are second nature to many officers. So I think that it's, I don't think the state can really say that, well, we just didn't have possession or control.
I think that's exactly what the state's saying. The state is saying that they did not have possession of the evidence that was requested, a copy of the video. They had knowledge of what the video had on it, but how do we distinguish, you know, how do we determine what the state was required to turn over?
Well, I think to start off, I think the state made that determination when it did, in fact, disclose this evidence. And that actually, I would back up and say before that, when the state, when the police officer filed his probable cause statement to the court, he was effectively representing to the trial court, I have evidence in my possession or control that shows that the defendant that the defendant committed a crime, and that was used to obtain the arrest warrant.
How is this situation different from if the officer, you know, in the discovery response, the state says, we have an eyewitness who will testify at trial and will testify about, you know, what that witness saw. And then the day of trial comes or, you know, we're going to make that witness available for a deposition. And then for whatever reason, that witness dies or is otherwise unavailable. How is that different than this situation? We have evidence. We'll get it to you as soon as we have it in our possession, and then it disappears. So
I think the difference in the hypothetical that you've given me is that if the witness died or was otherwise unavailable, that's not the responsibility of the state. If the state did something to affirmatively prevent this witness from testifying or was, somehow simply forgot to, you know, bring the witness to the deposition or whatever it may be, after affirmatively promising the defendant in their discovery motion that they would be able to do this, then I think that loss would be attributable to the state. I think that the state has an obligation to ensure that its officers follow through on what it does. The state also has an obligation to the defense to performance obligations in a timely manner, none of which was done here. There's several months between when the discovery motion was filed and when the state's response came, and then several months after that when the state finally revealed that this video had been lost. I think by the probable cause statement and then also the discovery response, they're effectively representing that they have this evidence that they're in, and they also, I believe this, the state also indicated that it intended to bring this evidence into trial. So I think it's entirely reasonable for the defense counsel to rely on the state's representations that it has this evidence and that it intends to preserve it. So it's, there's no question that the state was definitely on notice that this evidence needed to be preserved. As to the
You, in your brief, you make an interesting argument, and it was on page 24 of your brief. If physical possession was the sole criteria for such disclosure, litigants could easily circumvent their discovery obligations by simply refusing to, quote unquote, take possession of discoverable material until the moment it was needed, if at all. Isn't there a bad faith requirement in something like that? I mean, if it's, if that were the case, if the state knew that if they had evidence, they weren't going to take it because it was exculpatory or whatever the case may be, and they said, well, we're not even going to attempt to get this until the very last second, that would be bad faith on their part. Here, we don't have any bad faith.
So I don't believe that bad faith is a requirement specifically for a discovery violation. I think the more about the defendant's actual access to this and being able to see this evidence ahead of time and timely notice and such like that. It's that can be an element for determining a sanction. And I believe that this case certainly has lots of evidence of negligence, far right. beyond just.
I don't think anyone disputes that.
Yes, but I think it's important to note that that is a factor that the trial court considered when breaking this, as the state describes, excessive sanction. I see now that my time is up, but if there are any further questions, otherwise, I would ask that you simply affirm the trial court's decision.
Okay, I believe Justice McKinney has a question.
Counsel, what's your response to the suggestion of the state that an appropriate sanction instead of dismissal would have been simply the adverse inference jury instruction?
So I don't. First of all, I don't know exactly how that would work. There's no model jury instruction for criminal trials, I believe.
Okay. Use the IPI civil, just adapt that.
That could be. And that may be, that could be a solution. My response would be that that's not what the trial court decided here. The trial court is in the best position to decide what the sanction should be for any given discovery violation. And he considered all the alternatives, and he decided that dismissal was the only appropriate decision. So I don't think we can sit here and second guess things that weren't even raised by the state or by either party below, as maybe that could have been better. But
you've said that the trial court's ruling could be due process or discovery, right?
I think it could possibly be read as either.
My question is, what's your argument about waiver? How did the state waive?
So with respect to waiver, I would say that the state the state specifically, I never raised any of these discovery arguments about not having this evidence in possession. It never said that this evidence wasn't discoverable. And that occurred when it responded to the request. When it, when the motion to dismiss was filed, at the hearing, and even after the hearing, it never once said, well, we don't actually need to disclose this evidence. It was always assumed by both parties that this was discoverable. And frankly, I would argue that it was assumed that this was a discovery violation and that the question to be determined was whether dismissal was an appropriate sanction. So that would be at least part of my waiver argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This is Welch. Any questions?
No further questions.
All right, Mr. Smith, thank you. You'll have, you won't have time in rebuttal, but Mr. Daly, you do. And you are on mute right now. I'm sure that Courtney, there you go.
Yeah, I just wait until you're done, Judge. Okay, well, I'm gonna quote a couple of things from the record here for you. I'm gonna start with the state's discovery response, and this is paragraph B. The last sentence. The people are aware that video from Walmart may exist and will supplement discovery once that is received. So the state's not even representing in its discovery response it has anything in its possession at this point. It's just aware that something is out there, which is, of course, what prompted the state to go get this or attempt to get this video in the first place. You know, I don't want to delve into this kind of sort of pseudo-metaphysical discussion of whether possession is equal to knowledge. Because I just don't think that really realistically exists in this universe. What the state attempted to do is get a copy of this video. It didn't get a copy because the video didn't exist anymore. Any sort of tangible watchable item was possessed solely and singularly by Walmart throughout the course of this case. And the state, other than viewing it, and it knew its contents, but it didn't have a copy. Now, if this were going to go to trial, what's the state going to do? Okay. I mean, it could, in theory, have its witness testify to the contents of the video. I think there's a case I cite, which actually mentions that that doesn't violate the hearsay rule. But the fact of the matter is that this is a video whose contents show, represent video-wise, digitally-wise, you know, what happened or didn't happen on this parking lot, okay? So I think that this kind of meshing together of knowledge and possession, I think really confuses the issue here. The state just simply did not ever have in its possession any kind of tangible piece of evidence, which is exactly what the defendant was challenging in this case, okay? Turning again to the discovery violation, I'm going to quote now again from the record, and this is defendant's motion. Defendant respectfully submits paragraph 7 that the state, by failing to preserve this vital evidence, has violated the defendant's due process rights. Nothing in this motion mentions discovery. Nothing at all mentions discovery. Now, we discuss discovery here because for two reasons. One, as counsel points out, this court has, you know, broad discretion to affirm on any basis appears on the record. And I think counsel also points out accurately that Newberry itself, sort of sua sponte, if you read the decision closely, gets into the discovery issue kind of almost as a dicta type thing at the end, but it does make mention of that fact as well. I think it's supportive of the ultimate dismissal of the charges in that case. So I tied that position, if you will, to the waiver argument that counsel raises. I'm like, well, how does the state waive? And counsel argues, well, the state's waived, you know, issues related to discovery here. I'm not sure how you waive a discovery argument when it's never been raised in the first instance. So I'm a little confused by that particular position. But we could bypass all that by basically emphasizing here. I would emphasize here that the defendant brought this Newberry-based argument and cites due process in her motion. The state, I think, vigorously contested that, at least in terms of its applicability of Newberry to the facts of this case and how they're categorically different. I think the state reemphasized that notion in its motion to reconsider after the court's ruling. So I don't think that any sort of principle of waiver or estoppel should apply here, where it's really undisputed that the state had contested the defendant's position with regards to whether the dismissal of the charges in this instance was appropriate. Okay. Further, I think you'll find, Your Honor, I think Justice McKinney points out correctly as well, you know, there is a civil rule, and I know there are a number of criminal cases, I believe, and we're not discussed here since we didn't really get to that issue. But there's the missing evidence rule, if you will, has been employed in the criminal context as well. And there's other things that the court could have done as well. I mean, it could impose sanctions. It possesses a broad array of powers, far less than dismissal. But the point of the matter is, judges, I think the dismissal in this case, or really kind of any sanction, if we're looking through the prism of a due process violation, was just singularly inappropriate in view of all the circumstances of this case, in which really what we have here is the state is being punished for really nothing more than the police not doing their job properly. That's not what Youngblood says. That's not what Newberry says. That's not what Fisher says. That's not what any case says. And that's just a fact. So on that note, Your Honor, if the court has no further questions, I'll conclude now.
Justice McKinney, Justice Welch, anything?
No further? Questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments today and your briefs. We'll take these matter under consideration and issue its ruling in due course.